Hey, Bankless Nation. We are doing something new on the Bankless Podcast today. For those that don't know, me and Anthony Cesano, every Friday, not every Friday, but a decent number of Fridays, we get together and just do an unscripted, impromptu live stream. And so you can always catch that Friday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific time. And me and Anthony, we just talk about a bunch of Ethereum stuff. A lot of the Bankless podcasts and live streams that you guys watch are very, we have an agenda, we have topics that we want to get through. This is the time to have just completely unscripted conversations about what's been going on in the week of Ethereum with David and Anthony of The Daily Gwei. If you guys aren't listening to The Daily Gwei, I highly recommend the YouTube channel and also the newsletter. And Anthony just puts out roughly like 30-minute long videos just updating everyone about what's going on in the Ethereum ecosystem every single day. It's a fantastic resource, and that's kind of why I wanted to get closer with Anthony as a content producer with the Bankless podcast and Bankless YouTube. And so that's why we do these weekly live streams. One time we brought on DC to chit-chat, and you know, in the moving forward into the future, maybe we will bring on other guests for just, you know, some Friday evening fun times. And I think we're going to do more of that in the Bankless ecosystem. Me and my buddy Michael Wong, chief culturalist over at Bankless, we are chewing on something fun for some Friday evening entertainment. But until that comes around, just enjoy these weekly live streams with me and Anthony Cesano. And now we're putting them on the Bankless podcast as well for your weekend snacking. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. It was pretty fun. The theme this week was ETH Layer 2 Summer, and as well as the conversations around, is this a dead cat bounce or are we just in a stagnating bull market? So I hope you enjoy this conversation, but before we get into it, we have to take a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible. Balancer is DeFi's most powerful automated market maker. Typical AMMs just have two tokens inside of one liquidity pool, which can lead to fractured liquidity across the many pairs in DeFi. With Balancer, you can access the full power of multiple tokens inside of one single AMM, which unlocks an entirely new playing field of possibility. This makes Balancer an awesome building block for so many different use cases. Balancer pools can make asset indexes, but instead of paying fees to portfolio managers, Balancer lets you collect fees from traders who use your portfolio for liquidity. Additionally, Balancer smart pools can be programmed to have properties that change according to predetermined rules, such as changing the swap fee based on market conditions, or even liquidity bootstrapping pools, which can help you launch and distribute your token with day one liquidity. At Bankless, we used a liquidity bootstrapping pool to sell our BAP t-shirts to much success. Balancer V2 brings powerful new features that makes your money work even harder for you. In V2, idle tokens are capable of generating yield in DeFi without sacrificing liquidity in the pool. To top things off, Balancer is reimbursing gas costs with BAL rewards, meaning that your gas fees are reimbursed up to the cost of the transaction with the Balancer governance token. Balancer's mission is to become the primary source of liquidity in DeFi by providing the most flexible and powerful platform for asset management and decentralized exchange. Dive into the Balancer pools at pools.balancer.exchange today.
Guys, we've entered a bull market. Now is the time to start building your crypto empire, and you should do it on Gemini. You already know Gemini is the world's most trusted crypto exchange, but now you can do even more than trade. You can earn. You can take one of your crypto assets and park it in an interest-earning Gemini account where you can get up to 7.4% annualized. There's nothing more satisfying than earning passive income on an asset that you're already bullish on. This is a crypto-native superpower. You know what's coming soon too? A Gemini crypto credit card. Yep, that's a credit card, not a debit card. It gives you rewards in hard money crypto assets, not something inflationary like airline miles or hotel points. Gives you up to 3% cash back in crypto. The card is coming in Q2, but you should get on the waiting list right now and we'll include a link. See what I mean? This is more than just trading. Gemini is your bridge to crypto for the bull market. Open a free account in less than 3 minutes at gemini.com/gobankless. Get $15 in Bitcoin after you trade your first $100. That's gemini.com/gobankless.
What's up, Anthony?
Hey, David, how you going?
Oh, you know, hanging out. I'm in a different place right now. As we were literally just talking about where I was, not at my own home a second ago, and then we decided to live. But now I'm talking about it again. But yeah, I'm in an Airbnb in San Francisco on my way home.
Yeah, we're talking about how like you're able to like travel all over the country, and I'm just locked down in Melbourne again in my house.
yeah. I mean, as if it's any different when you work in the world of crypto. But yeah. World's in a weird space right now. So I guess I won't see you at Bitcoin Miami in a week. A week?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No. No. Okay.
I'll tell you all about it, though.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll say all about it on Twitter because like, there's tons of people going. And I mean, I was just saying to you, I saw that you can't even talk about anything but Bitcoin at the conference. So I'm like, I think there's going to be a lot of people just hanging around outside the conference, just at different places, which, you know, is pretty cool. That's what usually happens with conferences anyway. Like you go and then, you know, you do go to the main one, but you also kind of like hang out around it, which actually, that's the main thing I loved about conferences, just being able to hang with friends, like with online friends in real life. But yeah, can't do that. I won't be able to do that for a while.
There's two people that go to conferences, and people that go to conferences and then people that go to hang out, right? And not the last time. The last time we hung out was at ETH Denver. And ETH Denver is a very, like, I would say participatory conference. But the time before that was ETH New York. And ETH New York was very much separated between, like, it was meant for builders. It was meant for hackathon people and participants. And then there was all the other people who couldn't code, who just like were going there because we knew other Ethereum people were going there. And so that was ETH New York. That's where I met Eric for the first time. Oh, wait, you weren't there. Yeah, you weren't there. You weren't there. Oh, yeah. I met Eric for the first time. I met Hudson for the first time. And literally just like this like division between like people who are fiercely typing on their computers, like hacking, like Preston Van Loon, and all the other people who are just like fucking leaning back in their chairs, just like, oh, it's good to see you guys. This is great.
Yeah. I always love that though, because like I remember at ETH Denver, there was like three levels or something of devs, of developers like doing the hackathon, and then there was just everyone else crowding around. And it's funny because you have like different groups of people. One of the groups that you can pretty easily spot are like the VCs and the investors, because they'll huddle together and they'll just wait because they want to, you know, they want to obviously find their next investment and things like that. So, and you can kind of like see them moving around, like just looking at projects. And then yeah, as you said, they've got the laid back people just kicking it, hanging out, and then the hackers. But man, you're making me nostalgic now. I miss it. That's for sure. Haven't been to a conference since ETH Denver.
Dude,
I haven't been able to go.
I am fucking missing them, man. Like for all the listeners out there, if you're ever on the edge of like, do I go to this a conference thing or not? Like go. Absolutely go. Like it's where fucking Ethereum culture is. Like if you want to experience what crypto culture is, you got to go for the conferences. Speaking of culture and conferences, you just woke up. So you probably haven't seen the Mike Dudas tweet. Okay. So Mike Dudas tweeted out a poll. And he goes, what are you going to do in Miami next week since we're all going to be there? Option one, Bitcoin conference. Option two, Ethereum/DeFi/NFT. Option three, partying. Option four, all the above. Ethereum/DeFi/NFT is coming in at number one at 40.5%. Bitcoin conference is the loser at 8.4%. And then partying and all of the above are roughly tied. I need to go. I was trying to find like the actual poll because I voted on it a while ago and took that screenshot. But still, like and like I was planning on going to the conference until I found out that like so many Ethereum people are just going to be hanging out. And like if the Bitcoin, literally the Bitcoin rules are you can't talk about Ethereum stuff. This is a Bitcoin only conference. Then I guess I'll just go outside then.
Yeah, exactly. As I said, like I've been seeing tons of people say they're going, and I kind of expected that. There's a lot of Ethereum people going, and it's just more fun to talk about. Like I really don't like, I don't want to bash Bitcoin again here. I just like it's just more fun to talk about Ethereum and DeFi stuff, I guess, in general. And you know, that, I mean, that's why we talk about it all the time. Like I literally talk about it every day. You guys on Bankless talk about it all the time. So
day in, day out.
You know, it's. Yeah, exactly. It never gets old, and it's something always new and fresh. And you know, you just mentioned that I just got up. I did, and I literally have not caught up on what's happened. I looked at Twitter, and like, I just saw all the updates. I'm like, oh my god, a lot happened while I was sleeping again. Do you know what happened with? Apparently, there was some Twitter spaces where people were talking about how much money they made from pre-sales. Did you see that?
Oh, I saw some rumor about that, but now that's still something I'm not privy to.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there was something about like some big influencers on Twitter promoting, you know, pre-sales they got access to, and then you know selling them off or whatever. But regardless of that, I think, well, we haven't done this in 2 weeks, so the price, man, the price. What happened? Where did it all go wrong?
Oh my god. Well, 2 weeks ago, what were we doing 2 weeks ago? It was like at the all-time
high. Pretty sure
we're
at, yeah pretty
okay
sure
so
we're close
so
to
I have
that.
Two topics on the agenda for so far today. It's the question of,
you have an agenda. Oh,
two
God,
topics.
You betrayed me.
Two topics. I know it's because I know what you want to talk about, and you already brought up one of them, so give me the benefit of the doubt on the other one. The second one is layer 2 summer. For the other one, like, come on, like, I know what we're talking about.
The first one
is Dead Cat Bounce question mark. Since you brought it up, I guess we have to talk about Dead Cat Bounce question mark.
Man, I don't think so. Like, it's funny because the people I talk to, you know, they're on both spectrums, right? There's like the perma bulls and everything who find it really hard to be bearish in general, and I fall into that bucket. Like, this is why I can't trade, is because I'm just bullish all the time. And then you have like the people who are bearish, but they're only bearish because they want a better entry, from what I've noticed. Like, they want to just buy lower, and you know, and obviously people who are bullish just want to sell higher. So this is what's always funny about markets. You know, you can never really get an unbiased view from people because everyone's got their own agenda, everyone's got their own reason for wanting the market to go up and down. So you can never get like someone saying, oh, well, I actually think it's going to do this based on this, this, and this, because this makes the most sense. It's like, well, this makes the most sense to me for my bags.
Because
for
of what you're looking strategy. For, something, like something you're looking for this actually is what really the through line is.
Exactly. So, but yeah, I don't know. Like, I think everyone kind of got caught off guard by this. It was unexpected by, maybe not everyone. There were some people who were calling for like a 3K ETH, but that was based on like technicals and things like that. But then, you know, once we fell through that, we just fell even further. And it's been spoken about a lot lately, but I really do think it's the leverage in the system. There's just so much of it, and people just like you have such easy access to it that you have these death spirals because there's never enough spot liquidity to match this when there's liquidations and stuff like that. So, but yeah, man, I like just generally, I mean, it's impossible for me to be bearish on anything right now, even though the prices keep going down. It doesn't matter. Like, well, when you think about it, like I was really bullish we were both really bullish during 2019, like the depths of a bear market, and lots of stuff was happening, but the price wasn't moving. And when it comes to markets, they can kind of have a mind of their own sometimes, where both positive and negative news won't do anything to the markets. It'll just be like the market's doing the market things. So I guess that's where I'm sitting right now, but I'm sure you're in like a similar boat here.
Yeah, we could talk about how there was generally a just like kind of shitty 2 weeks in the narrative world, mainly on the Bitcoin side, right? Like Elon Musk just being erratic was bad. Like Dogecoins, like doggy tokens making the front page news, that was bad. Like there's shit that happened, like the real news, which is the China actually banning Bitcoin, actually doing it, that was bad, right? So we had like a series of like 1, 2, 3, 4 punches in a row right after just rocketing up. And so we had like no price consolidation. We didn't establish the highs, and then we got smacked by like really bad news, and then Bitcoin dumped and pulled the rest of the market down with it. And like, I think in the grand scheme of things, you're totally right. There's like when Ether goes from like $4,300 down to $1,700 in like 7 days, and then it rebounds $1,000 off of the floor. And then take, for example, we can talk about this hypothetical scenario that it just keeps on going over the long term. That's just a smooth line. Like it went up really fast and went down really fast, but then it was a smooth through and through. And what you're saying about like, there's just not enough liquidity in the market, it's just an anomaly of the fact that like the spikes are so high because of how little liquidity there is. And so you round out the spikes because it's noise. It's like an outlier, right? And just the fact that we dipped down to $1,700 for a brief couple hours in time was literally what you were saying. You just got to clear out the fucking leverage, bros. And so liquidity just like disappears. And so the price can do anything. The price can go to $50 and then it'll just go back to $2,500 a second later. And that's just an anomaly. That's not actually something that you should really, it's more of an anomaly than it is real. The reason why it's real is because a lot of people did get liquidated, and like a 60% drawdown off the top will spook anyone no matter what. Like watch your 60% of your net worth get deleted. It doesn't matter that you just only made it in the last like 45 days. Like you still got deleted. And still, that's my analysis.
Yeah, I think so. And that's why I think like even though obviously long-term bullish, I still think it's going to take a little bit to kind of like keep going up from here. Right. I think we're going to have to consolidate.
Pump the brakes.
Yeah, exactly. We're
going to be up too fast anyways.
Uh-huh. Yeah. See, this is the
Anthony
thing.
Anthony was like, that's an appropriate level of speed, actually.
I actually think that ETH wasn't going up fast enough, if I'm being honest. If we were, you know, traditionally when you see a drawdown like this on, you know, large market cap assets like Bitcoin or ETH, you know, if we're looking at past cycles, you would expect to see maybe a 40% drawdown at most. We've seen that already, right? We saw that from, I think, 2100 to 1300 was about a 40% drop or something like that. Whereas, you know, getting a 60% drop on ETH is incredibly scary, especially when ETH has such a high market cap these days and has such a wide and varied holder base. Mm-hmm. And I know we kind of like bounced off that really quickly. But the thing is, like, think about it, 4,400 to 1,700 in a week is crazy. Like, we fell way faster than we went up.
Yeah, but only so, like two or three times as fast. Like, we went up pretty fast, bro.
Yeah, but
It was like two and a half times as fast. It was like three weeks versus 1 week.
But you know, but the thing is, I actually think that ETH, so it's hard to say like what's fairly valued, but I actually think that ETH didn't go up fast enough. But I think that what ended up happening was that there was a lot of other crap happening, right? Mm-hmm. There was, as you mentioned, the dog tokens. There was just a lot of froth in the market generally. Bitcoin was actually weak for quite a while. You can see on the chart that Bitcoin was weak for like 3 months, man. It was like ranging and it was actually going down. It wasn't exactly going back up.
Ranging down, not ranging up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And then, you know, you mentioned all the bad news that came out, like the ESG narrative, the Elon Musk stuff, all that sort of stuff. That just, you know, I think that just like, basically or like tipped over an already wonky kind of horse, so to speak, right? It was already ready to kind of like, you know, dump. And also Bitcoin dominance had gotten slaughtered. We went over this 2 weeks ago, how Bitcoin dominance had gotten absolutely slaughtered, which means that there was people kept saying, oh, when's alt season? I'm like, guys, it was alt season. Like, yes, you're waiting for DeFi season, which is different to alt season. Alt season is literally all the scams and like absolute crap pumping. And we had that. We had that in a very big way. It's just that people think that alt season means that their bags are going to pump. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that just really shitty bags are going to pump, but maybe your bags aren't part of that shitty bag. Right. So, I think that definitely you're right that this is going to spook a lot of people. It's definitely going to spook a lot of the institution, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them, the institutional investors who are like, wow, you know, this is really volatile, but maybe they won't allocate as much money now. They'll allocate some. They'll be like, okay, well, this asset class is still extremely risky and extremely volatile. Let's allocate less than we were going to because of it for now.
Right.
But yeah, man. And I actually think the narratives aren't going away for Bitcoin. We've spoken about this before, and just like the energy use narrative is just such a bad one, I think, really in general sucks. For Bitcoin. And doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, it's a narrative that's very powerful, and people just gonna look at that and be like, wow, Bitcoin uses this much energy, like this is horrible. Whereas with Ethereum, soon we'll be able to just say, well, Ethereum doesn't use mining, and that's it. Like, we don't have to say anything else. It's like, it doesn't use mining.
Right. It uses literally nothing. That's the whole point. It actually uses Ether, which is not nothing, but from Nick Carter was making this point about how he was talking, ironically, he was talking about like the Chia or Chaya network, which uses like proof of hard disks. And so you just have like hard disks farming where you just have all these hard disks, and they're just writing random data to these hard disks and then deleting them over and over and over again. And so like, and then the hardware's burn out. Same model as the ASIC. What the hell was he saying? He was talking about how this network got so large so fast that it actually started to tap into like commodity resources. And then he was talking about how like this is why you don't like bake financial products into like general like commodities like corn or something, because like society needs corn. Like we don't want the prices of corn to artificially skyrocket for no fucking reason for this art, like for this weird thing. And then he's like, and this is why Chia makes no sense. But to me, I was so confused, because then he turned it into a positive about Bitcoin. And I'm like, dude, what's the one commodity that all humans need? It's energy. Like, what? I know we can create more energy, but we can also create more corn. Like, I lost that part of it. Like, that's the one part about the one thing, few things that Nick Carter have said. I was just like, I don't get this.
Yeah, I don't get the hypocrisy. And I think I was actually thinking about this, and I was going through a scenario in my head, and I was thinking, okay, if I asked a Bitcoiner, hey, aren't you being, you know, hypocritical by saying that Chia is a waste, but Bitcoin isn't, you know, wasting kind of electricity here and kind of like hardware? Their reply would be, yeah, but Bitcoin's worth it. Like 100%. I already know what their reply would be, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, that's actually a fine stance to take. I actually think that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you really shouldn't be calling out other kind of like waste,
because it's subjective. It's subjective.
Exactly,
what it's worth.
you know, as a Bitcoiner, you think that Chia is useless and you think it's worthless, but like there are people who like Chia and like find it valuable and mine it and want to make money off it. So yeah, it's extremely subjective. And this is why the debate is never going away, because it's just a subjective debate. There's no objective answer here. There's no good or bad. It's what people think is good or bad and what they feel is a benefit or not for the planet. So yeah, I don't know, man. That narrative has extreme headwinds. And you know, I know you mentioned Nick Carter. He does a lot to fight it off and puts out a lot of good work around it, but that's not going to matter. Like, most people aren't going to read Nick Carter's blog posts. Like, it's as simple as that.
Right. He's just like hammering out blog posts after blog posts, but like, he's doing his best, man. But like, he's not winning. Like, he's losing. And like, the whole Elon Musk and Michael Saylor, like, mining council thing, like, we're going to establish the North American Mining Council to like make Bitcoin green. That's capitulation. That's Bitcoiners admitting defeat and that they have to tackle this problem head on. And then they did it in this extremely ungracefully way where we're going to like establish the Council of American Bitcoin Miners. And so all of you Bitcoin miners, which is an opt-in, but still, like, let's all get the miners all in one spot and have a council. Like, well, come on, guys.
Yeah, man.
What is this?
Yeah. It definitely looks like fear, like a little bit of fear where they're like, well, we know this narrative is really bad. And if we don't get on top of it, it's really bad for Bitcoin. And they won't ever say it, but they'll think to themselves, well, you know, Ethereum doesn't have this problem soon enough. Like, even though some of them will say Ethereum's never going to proof of stake, well, it's like, it is. And once it does, like, what do you got? Like, after that, it's pretty bad. But and I'm just so happy that Ethereum is moving to proof of stake, and it's been a plan for quite a while now. I'm happy it's not just a reactionary thing. I'm happy that it was like very kind of like a set in stone back in the
baked
day. And we've been
into
working
the
towards
ethos.
It.
The ethos selected it from day one, and it was the right ethos to go by. Like, this is like every single day, I'm just like impressed by like, oh, like all these people that are like, humanity's now debating consensus mechanisms in 2021, and like Vitalik was like, hey guys, I'm gonna solve this problem 6 years in advance that you guys don't even understand that's coming.
Vitalik's foresight has been amazing to see. He's like, I mean, even in the white paper, DeFi use cases were mentioned, like financial use cases. It wasn't DeFi back then, but financial use. Like, he just had so much foresight, and just generally, I think like the Ethereum community is very lucky to have him. But yeah, generally, just that. When it comes to a narrative war, for people who pay attention to what happens on Twitter, like, just even, okay, let's pivot a little bit for a sec to talk about narrative wars. Look at what happened with 1559, right? Look, over the last couple of days, people are now concerned trolling EIP 1559 and saying that it was people always sold it as a way to improve gas fees. It was never, ever sold as that. Not from when it first got created, not from any of us in this ecosystem, like not from any of the people with a reach. I made a point to never, ever sell it as something that would reduce gas fees. I often noted that it may work to, that it should work to smooth out transaction fees because that is part of its design, but I had never alluded to it, you know, fixing the gas fees. And I always said that that was layer two, right? That was not the EIP 1559. But now we have people coming along and saying, well, that's what it was sold as. I'm like, are you serious? Like, are you just learning about 1559 now? Like, who are you listening to? It's just the narrative war is such a hard one to win, because even if you think you've won it, someone will come along and throw a spanner in it, and then everyone will be confused. This is what happened when, I'll just say it, like Taylor Monahan put out this thread that started this whole thing. She confused everyone, because now everyone is trying to kind of, you know, latch onto a narrative and latch onto an explanation for it. And now there's kind of like revisions of history happening too. People are like, oh, maybe it was about this all along, or maybe it wasn't about this. And it's like, it's just so insane, because we had a very cohesive narrative the whole time, but then someone can come along and just like screw it all up, I think.
And it also doesn't even matter what the motivations are. It's a piece of code. We can analyze and analyze the code as the code itself, right? And like, to also, for what it's worth, if we're talking about intent, it was intended to just make the UX better, and now it's touted as this fee burn mechanism. And if I remember, I didn't look into the thread too much because I was like, this is dumb, I'm not gonna waste my time on this. And so the reason why I think Taylor Monahan is going after EIP 1559 is because she's a contrarian, and like, everyone likes EIP 1559. And so like, the reason why people like it is because it burns ETH and it pumps their bags. But that's not why it was actually ever implemented. The first proposal was framed in the context of just making gas an easier thing to use. I was not the first person to like talk about the relationship between burning ETH and ETH scarcity, but I think I had like the first article that was really about EIP-1559 that was directly about that. And it was really just out of the social layer that EIP-1559 turn into this like bullish fundamental case of Ethereum's monetary policy after the fact, after Eric Conner was like, this is going to make using gas easier. Now, there's a conspiracy that I have that Vitalik, because Vitalik knew about EIP-1559, or at least like the original construction of it, the original mechanism. And then he might have like passed it to Eric and be like, yo, you submit this EIP, because Vitalik's smart. He's like, well, this is going to make Ether be scarce. And so I think Vitalik was like, Eric, like, you go do this. that's my conspiracy
theory. Vitalik had been talking about this sort of stuff since 2016. And he was never talking about like fee burns or whatever. He was talking about improving the gas mechanism for Ethereum.
Interesting.
So there's papers back in 2016, 2017, 2018, and 1559 was put forward in 2019. But on your point about people saying, it's all about the fee burn now. Okay. Well, okay. Let's put it this way. Let's see what the fee burn actually does besides just your vanilla. Oh, it pumps people's bags. The fee burn takes the money that's going to miners right now in terms of fee revenue and distributes it to all fee holders and makes ETH a kind of revenue generating or like a value capture token. Because right now ETH does not capture the value of its own network, because it is not, I mean, it can be used as collateral, it's staking and all that sort of stuff, but it is not capturing that fee revenue. So by you saying that, oh, you don't like 1559 because it burns fees and directs value to ETH, you're taking the other side and saying you're happy with that ETH going to miners who dump it, right? That's the side you're taking, really.
Decreasing
at the end
the security
of
Ethereum when you dump it, by the way.
Exactly. Decreasing the security of Ethereum and also causing chain instability, because when you have more fee revenue than block rewards, it's been shown in a research paper that this can lead to an instable blockchain or an unstable blockchain.
Right.
So when I see that, I'm just like, guys, like, okay, yes, it's good for the value of ETH, and yes, a lot of the industry is shilling it like that. But at the end of the day, like, who are these people following? Like, are you just following traders who are shilling this so that they can trade ETH and, like, you know, pump it higher based on this narrative? Like, I know I've been talking about the fee burn a lot for sure, but the thing is that the fee burn is just like a really easy narrative for people to latch onto. Like, and when I look at people arguing against this, I'm like, you guys should never work in marketing, because you didn't understand how marketing works. Like, marketing works by boiling down complex topics into an easy to digest narrative. That's really the crux of marketing. So when you want to market 1559, you want to get the word out about it, what do you start with? Well, you start with the most attractive feature of it, like, which is an ETH fee burn. Then you can talk about the other things. That's what I've done. I've gotten people to kind of like, you know, listen to me because of that. And then I kind of like ETH pill them later on the better things about 1559. So to me, it's just like a marketing narrative thing that I think a lot of people in this industry do not understand. You know, marketing is something that I think people look down upon sometimes. And they're like, oh, you're just trying to shill your bads. It's like, everyone's trying to shill something. Like, let's just be honest here. Like, everyone is always trying to shill something. Like, is Taylor, you know, shilling just her bags with my crypto? Of course she is. Like, but that's fine. It's her product, right? Like, it's fine. So yeah, I mean, maybe without ranting too much there, I just think that the forest for the trees gets missed a lot in this industry.
Totally. And on the note of just like everyone shilling their bags, like all content producers, all YouTubers, all podcasters, everyone writing an article, they're all shilling their bags. The reason why people write articles is because they write about something that they believe in. That's why Bitcoiners have so many Bitcoin podcasts. That's why Ethereum people, we could use some more podcasters actually these days. It's mainly you, me, and a few other people, and that's about it. But like, we're all shilling our bags. But the thing is, someone is right. Like, someone shilling their bags is right. There's all these different people shilling their bags, and someone's right. And so at some point, that's why you have to be like a thesis-driven shiller. Because if you're the shiller who's shilling their bags and you're wrong, then you're like an asshole in hindsight. Not an asshole. I wouldn't really call him an asshole. But like, you're the one that got it wrong. Like, you were just shilling your fake bags, right? And if you are the shiller that got it right, you're the person that democratized alpha, right? Like, you're the one that did all, like, good job. And so like at that point, like, that's why you kind of, it's a responsibility to shill bags if you do believe in them, because that's your right as a person.
And I guess, like, in saying that, all shilling is not created equal either, right? You have a lot of things that are shilled that are scams or dodgy projects, or people have access to, like, you know, I was just saying before about like pre-sales, right? Where there's no kind of vesting or lockup on their tokens. They shill it to their followers and then they just like dump on them, right? That happens a lot in this industry, and I'm not condoning that at all. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but you know, when I shill ETH, I'm more shill like you know, the fundamental drivers of like ETH and Ethereum and what's happening there, and obviously, like, you know, me and you, it's the same thing. We're both like long-term Ethereum people. We're not just like shilling some bags you got in a pre-sale. I mean, you and I, we bought we bought ETH way later than
my
than,
first price was
people.
Like $330.
Exactly. So
2017, right? Not in the 2018-19 bear market. Like, it was not $80 at the bottom of the bear market. It was like $330, and then it pumped to $1,400. I'm like, yes. And then it fell to $80. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, exactly. So I think a lot of people miss that. There's you know, some of the loudest people in this ecosystem, and the ones you would call shillers, bought in a lot later. So they're not kind of like shill like bags they bought in at like pre-sale and things like that. But yeah, I mean, and shilling's like, it's got a negative connotation that comes with it. At the end of the day, it's just talking about things you're excited about, really. That's how I view it. And yeah, okay, yes, you have a monetary incentive to do so, but that's like this whole industry. If you're talking about something, most of the time you have an incentive to do so, whether that's being monetary or social, and it can be both. Like, you can have a social incentive to do things. Like, obviously I have a social incentive to talk about Ethereum because like, that's my whole thing. Like, and the same with you guys at Bankless, it's your whole thing. But you make money from it too, because it's part of like there's no way I'm going to shill Ethereum if I don't have ETH. Like, why? Right. Like, yes, I love Ethereum, but like, I'm going to invest in ETH. Like, I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and be like, oh yeah, ETH can go up without me, it's fine.
Why? I think it's going to go up into the moon, but I'm not going to buy it. Like, what?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So there's just, it's that's just like being a rational investor, being a rational person. So yeah, when I think about that, that's kind of like the train of thought I go down, and I'm fine with people thinking it's gross and disgusting sometimes where people are shilling things. But guys, like, I don't see that with ETH. I see that with like the dog coins or like the outright scams, like or the really shitty projects. I just do not see that with something like ETH, where you can say, oh, it's disgusting shillers just trying to pump their bags. Right. Guys, if we wanted to shill bags and pump bags, we wouldn't be pumping like ETH. Right. We'd be pumping something else. But we don't want to do that, right? We're not here for that.
Yeah. It's easier. Well, shilling ETH is like long-term games, right? And the reason why it's a long-term game is because we think it's a long-term asset, right? So, like, come back to, you know, the Bankless YouTube in like 50 years, Anthony and David still shilling ETH, like, still gonna be doing it. It's probably. Hey guys, we're about to get into the topic of conversation of Layer 2 Summer, or what's about to happen when Arbitrum and Optimism open the floodgates and allow all the developers to come and start building on these L2s, and what it's going to be like once all those applications are built for L2s, the users, and what it's like for the users to come and live in those L2s. I think it's going to be a really exciting time. Anthony agrees with me. So that is the second half of this conversation. But before we get there, we have to take a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible.
Guys, we've entered a bull market. Now is the time to start building your crypto empire, and you should do it on Gemini. You already know Gemini is the world's most trusted crypto exchange, but now you can do even more than trade. You can earn. You can take one of your crypto assets and park it in an interest-earning Gemini account where you can get up to 7.4% annualized. There's nothing more satisfying than earning passive income on an asset that you're already bullish on. This is a crypto native superpower. You know what's coming soon too? A Gemini crypto credit card. Yep, that's a credit card, not a debit card. It gives you rewards in hard money crypto assets, not something inflationary like airline miles or hotel points. Gives you up to 3% cash back in crypto. The card is coming in Q2, but you should get on the waiting list right now, and we'll include a link. See what I mean? This is more than just trading. Gemini is your bridge to crypto for the bull market. Open a free account in less than 3 minutes at gemini.com/gobankless. Get $15 in Bitcoin after you trade your first $100. That's gemini.com/gobankless.
Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. input the token you want to sell, and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. And now, Anthony, I think we should turn to the main conversation, which is Layer 2 Summer. How do you feel about that?
I'm feeling like if we say Layer 2 Summer too much, people are going to accuse us of overpromising something. That's what I feel like, because I already saw it happen with the Arbitrum release today. People are complaining and saying, oh, it's only for developers. Guys, like every single piece of marketing copy said it was only for developers. What do you think? Like, literally, I have not seen anyone say that it was for users. So where do these people get this idea from that it was for users? And I think it's got to do with the fact that when people hype things up, again, it goes back to what I was saying about narratives and marketing. You always kind of focus on the best thing, right? Mm-hmm. The most awesome thing coming. Mm-hmm. And what all people focused on was, oh, Arbitrum is going to like be a layer two that comes out before Optimism, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be like where all these developers can deploy their stuff to, and users will be able to enjoy the cheap and fast transactions. That is true, but that is not true today. And what's true today is that they need to release a developer mainnet so that they can actually get the apps on there. This is another thing that I don't get when people kind of say this. Like, okay, guys, if they released it to the public today, what would you go and do?
There's nothing there.
I don't get it.
What, you expect like, oh, Ethereum, but on Arbitrum? Like, no, you got to go build it.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't get that. And I don't get how people were thinking that. But anyway, that's what released today, right? Arbitrum. Mm-hmm. And then there's other layer twos that have been rolling out slowly. There's other apps and stuff. There's layer twos live today. You can go use them and things like that. But I think layer two summer is something that is not just going to happen coherently. It's not just going to be one thing that, happens at one point in time, like DeFi summer did. I think it's going to take a little while still for layer twos to roll out to a point where you can have like, you know, a critical mass of users on there doing all sorts of, you know, really cool things. Right. But I think it can happen eventually. It's just that I thought I was under promising a lot of things, even though like I'm bullish on them, but it seems like people still think we're over promising things. And it really kind of like irks me because, you know, I think on Twitter, it's just different. On Twitter, people, because Twitter doesn't lend itself to nuance at the end of the day. Twitter lends itself to what can you fit in 280 characters and how much engagement can you farm? And that's fine. That's exactly what I do. It's what you do. It's what like all of us do. Like we want to get attention to our long form stuff and our, you know, our YouTube channels, our newsletters, whatever. But the only way we can do that is by creating these bite-sized narratives that get people to pay attention to us and to follow us. And by doing that, we remove a lot of the nuance from things. So I get that. But if you're just taking your knowledge from Twitter only, right, from one person's tweet, then you're just not doing enough research into what's happening, because you can't get everything from one tweet. Even a tweet thread is not going to give you everything.
Right.
So that's my general opinion on Layer 2 Summer, is that we shouldn't overpromise this and we shouldn't say that this is going to be a coherent thing. It's going to eventually happen where there are critical massive users will move to Layer 2s and we'll have like some fun stuff happening on there. But I don't think it's going to happen like people think it is, like where it's just like all of a sudden, oh my God, everything's pumping, Layer 2 Summer, wee. No, I don't think it's going to happen like that.
So here's my model for how this goes. And maybe adding summer to it is more just like marketing and excitement, which, I mean, we're always excited. But Layer 2 season, era, whatever. So here's how I've been explaining this to my friends. Imagine like Disneyland, but you've probably never been to Disneyland, have you?
Disneyland in Tokyo, so I guess that counts.
Okay, so an amusement park. The Disneyland that I'm familiar with in Anaheim in Los Angeles, it's like very much you go in through the gates, and then you go up to this main Walt Disney statue, and then there's like different parks, like park this way, a different park that way, a different park that way. And so you have like this main Disneyland area and then all these different parks like spawning off of it, right? And so this is what Ethereum is. Like main park, super congested, lines everywhere because there's only one spot to go. The lines are super long. And now Ethereum as an ecosystem, they just launched like the Matic Park not too long ago, the Polygon Park, and now they're about to launch the Arbitrum Park, and then they're about to launch the Optimism Park, which are even way more, like way more surface area. And instead, and when they launch these things, there's this massive, like, for at first, it's kind of like a gold rush, but people have to wait for the developers of like these applications to come and build the future rides that people are going to ride on, so that the people can come find the gold, because the gold's in the ride. Okay, so here, so like SushiSwap comes, and they're going to, and Uniswap, they're going to come deploy on Arbitrum. And this is completely my speculation, but like, in order to get liquidity onto Arbitrum, perhaps both Uniswap and Arbitrum, and I'm just using these as examples, so like insert your DeFi app here. Uniswap does uni distribution rewards to people providing liquidity on Arbitrum. Arbitrum provides rewards for people using Uniswap on Arbitrum. And so you have these dual yield farming coming from both application, which is like the ride, and the actual real estate, which is Arbitrum. And we repeat that for every single application, borrowing and lending application. Like Aave is going to probably take the lead here because it can move so much faster than Compound. So Aave is going to be yield farming Aave tokens on Arbitrum, which is also going to be giving Arbitrum tokens. And then also they're going to repeat this on Optimism, right? Everyone, we need to give away the tokens of these L2s because we need them to be decentralized. How do you give away tokens? We learned this in the first DeFi summer. We just give them away to people that use the protocols. And so there's going to be yield farming on Arbitrum. There's going to be yield farming on Optimism. There's already yield farming on Matic, right? And so it's just going to be fucking yield farm city in like these three different like parks that are brand new. And the important thing is there's no fucking fees. There's no fees. And so that that is like the bull case. I'm super fucking excited for this. Why I'm calling this Ultrasound Summer, and maybe also fall or whatever. Just Ultrasound, or not Ultrasound, Layer 2
or
Summer.
Or winter for those in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. There's not that many of you.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, a big part of these like summers is the yield farming and the liquidity mining, right? And the conditions have to be good for this though. You need a bullish market. You can't have like a bearish market because liquidity mining doesn't really work in a bearish market.
Right.
You need a bullish market.
Gotta go up.
Exactly. And we already saw a taste of this on Polygon with Aave launching Matic token rewards on Polygon there. So you could, and we saw like, I think there's $17 billion in Aave on Polygon right now because of that. So yeah, as you said, like if all these tokens are being given away through liquidity mining programs, it's a really easy way and good way to bootstrap liquidity. And I think that this is what's going to happen for a lot of these apps. And some will move faster than others and things like that. And you can't have liquidity mining on like every single L2. So maybe this is a race here where, you know, who can bring out their L2 or scalability solution, you know, first, so to speak. So I think from that perspective, it makes sense. But, you know, it depends on what the broader market does as well. I think, as I said, like we're not long-term bearish, but like short-term, the market is just like, no one knows what's going to happen in the short term right now in the markets. Like absolutely no one. I think people are betting on it's going to take a couple of months for it to work itself out because we got ourselves into a really bad rut here. And every single bounce is going to be sold down because people are going to be like, well, I'm going to sell the relief bounce. Be like, oh, I should have sold here. And now they're like, oh, it bounces. And they're going to be like, oh, I should sell here. And I think a lot of people are saying, well, unless ETH breaks 3K, we're going to be stuck in like the 2K to 3K purgatory for a little while. So if unless that happens, or maybe, you know, the funny thing is maybe this all happens at once because these events have a really funny way of like all coalescing around each other. So if you think about what's happening in the next couple months, say the market starts hitting it back up in July, for example, again, I think Arbitrum will be open to users in either kind of like I'm estimating late June or early July here. And what else is happening in July? Well, Optimism is also said that they're going to go live with a mainnet in July. 1559 is still happening in July, as far as I know. I saw something about like a slight delay on it on Twitter before, but I think it's still happening in July, right? So if we get like a return of the bull in July, well, then we can possibly have an L2 summer, right? Because the conditions are there for it. I think the reason why we had like a DeFi summer originally is because the conditions were there for it. It was the market was just getting started, heating up. We just discovered this really cool new primitive. Fees were low and then spiked high, but people didn't care about the fees because they had made so much money from their ETH holdings. Like people forget that the people who were part of DeFi summer were early ETH investors. So at that point in time, they didn't care about the fees because they had made a lot of money from their ETH going up. So they were like, well, all right, it doesn't matter. Like I'm getting all this money from this. I don't care about the fees. And then it was just a new thing as well. So as you were saying, this is like going to be a zero to low fee kind of environment where it's going to be a new thing for people, where they're going to be like, the people who were locked out before are going to be like, well, I can actually do like all this cool yield farming stuff now. And there's going to be centralized exchange bridges in and things like that for people to kind of come into it. So yeah, I think the conditions can be there in maybe June, like maybe late June, kind of like July-ish, but we're going to have to see what the broader market does. If the broader market is like super bearish and Bitcoin's like dumping, ETH's dumping, right. I don't see us having like an L2 kind of like season like because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. To some degree, maybe you can have like some amount of faith in markets and say like, well, because Optimism and Arbitrum are releasing and this real estate is going to be so incredibly valuable, that like, that can be its own catalyst and be the reason why we are bullish. Not that people's bearishness kill the potential for L2 summer or L2 whatever. It's actually the fact that these things are happening is what makes it bullish. It could go both ways. It could go like at some point in time, catalysts move markets. It's an extremely viable catalyst. And as what you said, like there's already plans for certain exchanges to just put USDC right onto these L2s. And so I've been talking to some of my friends. One of my friends owns bonds. So that's stupid. And so I'm telling him, sell all your bonds and just put it into stable coins and yield farm on all these L2s that are coming. Just like you can keep your dollar principles. Like I'm not even going to bother to try and convince you to buy ETH. He doesn't own ETH. But I was like, well, your bonds are yielding like butt fuck percentages. Excuse my French on the bond market. go farm some actual real assets. Like this is the future. Mm-hmm. Go do that. Like no, same risk kind of. And so like if you the time to deploy just bare cash is like kind of coming up like pretty damn soon, and you don't have to buy ETH, you don't have to put it into risky assets, you can keep your principal, but in the spirit of going bankless, you're going to get better yields in the bankless world, like, and so you might as well go do that.
I totally think so, and this has been my kind of like thesis for a while as to why I don't think we're going to get like a long drawn out bear market anymore. And I think we're going to get like mini cycles is because of that. As you said, like, I mean, where are you going to put your cash, right? Where are you going to put your USD if not in crypto? Like, are you going to go to a bank account? No. Like, what are you going to do within a bank account? Are you going to go buy bonds? No. What are you going to do with bonds, right?
It's the most ignorant thing on the planet.
Exactly. Are you going to go in the stock market? I'm like, okay, maybe you can go in the stock market, but like you're still buying assets. You're not holding onto your cash.
Right.
Whereas, and this is why I'm saying like with if you keep your cash in stable coins, well, you're looking for a dip to buy. You're not looking to exit crypto. You want to buy a dip or you want to yield farm. You're keeping the capital within the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, I mean, I think it's very hard to be kind of like bearish, like even medium term. Like I think short term is fine because short term can do whatever it wants. But long-term, medium, long-term, like bullish, just like everywhere. Like there's just seriously, like I just can't find any reasons to be bearish. And think about how many users have still got to come into the ecosystem as well. And how many of them are locked out because we don't have, because we have high fees, and what that's going to unlock on L2 is going to be amazing. So yeah, I think people might get blindsided by this, and the memes of like, oh, Ethereum can't scale. We're just going to die. Like, and that goes back to what I was saying about narratives and narrative war. It's very hard for Ethereum to win the Ethereum can scale narrative war just based on promises and based on us saying, well, you know, this is coming out soon. Once we get it out there and people can actually use it and people see that, oh, wow, this is actually real. That's when, I think things start changing. I think Polygon had played a pretty big part in this as well, where, you know, they kind of showed this and kind of like you go on there and I know there was debates about Polygon being like not an L2 and all this sort of stuff, but you know, generally it's an Ethereum aligned scaling solution. And that showed people that, you know, when Ethereum wants to, it can scale both on the technical level and the social kind of coherence level too.
Right. The one thing I don't know about Matic is like if the Matic network blows up, like what kind of assurances do you have that you can come back to Ethereum? I think that's kind of like the weakness that Matic has, is it doesn't have perfect assurances in the same degree that Optimism and Arbitrum does. And so like you can't have perfect like security when you are on Matic. Like there is some risk there. But at the end of the day, if it works, it works. And right now it's working. And so like whatever, we can talk about compromises for whatever, but like if it's offloading scaling fees and reducing fees, then like count it as an L2. You know, we're gonna like, it's not technically an L2, that's technically incorrect, but like, you know, people, random users of Ethereum aren't gonna give a shit. Like, they're just like, oh, it's the thing things I do are cheaper. That's the L2, I'll go over there. Like, they don't care what it is. And so like to some degree, that's probably why people are so bullish on Matic now is not only is it's already first, people are already building on it. It's got all those like oh, any sort of L2, like it's all automatic. It's all automatic. Like, I guess that's bullish. Don't really know like how architecturally why that works, or but okay. And so to some degree, sure, whatever. Count it as an L2, like so long as it works.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to these sorts of things, it's just the trade-offs, right? And the Polygon POS network, or the automatic network, as you were talking about, they have their own validator set, like 100 plus proof of stake validators. They have slashing. All that logic lives on Ethereum. They checkpoint to Ethereum. But the actual central point of failure is the multisig bridge, which essentially is the bridge from Ethereum to Matic, which holds billions of dollars of assets. That is a 5 of 8 multisig right now. So if you know they wanted to, not saying they would, five people could collude and steal all the funds in there, right? And that the thing is that multisig is not there for any malicious reasons. It's there because they want to be able to upgrade the platform still, and because the platform is still very early, and they want to protect user funds in case of any exploits and stuff like that. This is not dissimilar to what happens with DeFi apps, when DeFi apps have admin keys and stuff like that.
Or WBTC, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So just that's the thing. Just as long as people understand the trade-offs, I think is fine. The definition war, like the narrative war around defining things, is already lost, even though that I think technically in L2, like, is something that's secured by Ethereum directly and doesn't rely on its own kind of security. And, you know, Matic or Polygon has been referred to as a side chain. I just think that even that kind of term is useless. I think it's all about, you know, is it like its own network? Is it secured by itself, which Polygon's POS chain is? Okay, where's the central point of failure here? Well, it's the bridge, right? So okay. The bridges really are generally kind of like the central points here. And you know, who's responsible for the bridge? Like what are their social coherence? And I think, you know, I should disclaim that I'm an advisor to Polygon, but I think that, you know, the team is not like malicious or anything like that. He's not trying to harm Ethereum or anything. They're kind of very aligned there. So, and you know, even these other, like, I guess you can call them true L2s, like Arbitrum and Optimism, are going to have guardrails on them in some way or another. I don't know if they're going to be centralized guardrails or anything like that, or kind of admin keys. But they are definitely going to have ways to, I mean, just think about it. Like if Arbitrum and Optimism want to upgrade their networks once they're live, like how are they going to do that without like a multisig where they can actually just like put the upgrades in themselves? Well, they'd have to set up a whole governance process. That's not going to work really early on in their life. It's going to hamper their adoption because they're not going to be able to move fast. So I think early on in these projects, it's fine to have an admin key. It's fine to have a central point of failure as long as you're upfront about it. If you're kind of like trying to hide this fact, well, I mean, if you're trying to hide it, then I consider you malicious.
That's a different story. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Cause you're hiding information from the market, not allowing them to decide for themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is why I had such a big problem with BSC, is that CZ is marketing BSC as if it's exactly like Ethereum, right? That it's just like Ethereum with low fees. I was like, no, man, it's like centralized Ethereum. Like, stop with this bullshit marketing. And, you know, I think as long as people are honest about what these systems are and people understand what they are, that's fine by me. I think, you know, if you're lying to people, that's when it gets like kind of gross.
Yeah, totally. What should we talk about next?
Well, I mean, markets, L2 1559 drama,
chat. What should we talk about? Let us know.
Give us a topic. There's lots we could talk about, but maybe they've got something they want to hear about.
I've always wanted to do like a just like, have you ever used the webinar feature of Zoom? I guess it's not all that different than YouTube having a chat function, but Polygon low-key Cardano killer. Well, you have to be alive to be killed. So.
you know, I always viewed Polygon as these not so much Cardano, but as these kind of like these interoperability multi-chain protocol things like Polkadot and what was the other one? Cosmos. Yeah. So I always viewed Polygon as that, because they're going to they're not just building the POS chain, they're building like what they call internet of blockchains, which is going to be like standalone chains, L2s, you know, all this sort of stuff, hybrids, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, that's what I view it as. But as you say, yeah, Cardano, I mean, what's there to kill? Like,
right. you know what I haven't heard anything about? The Compound chain. When's the last time you heard about something about the Compound chain?
I actually saw Robert Leshner tweeting about it on Twitter, like I think 2 days ago, and saying that Arbitrum should have like a star port on the Compound chain. I'm like, okay, well, what is actually happening with this Compound chain? Like, what is it right now?
Apparently there's a new assets in Compound, Link and True USD. So they actually added some new assets to base L1 main chain to Compound. So like, that's the first thing that's changed about that application. And I guess to some degree, they're kind of stuck being like the ultra secure application versus Aave, which is kind of the move fast, but not yet break things, fingers crossed, app. And so like, I guess if Compound does start rolling out the features, then it kind of breaks what it's good for, which is like a really locked down vault.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of money market protocols now with more coming. I mean, you have like ones that move really fast, like Cream and Fuse from Rari Capital. And then you have ones that move, you know, a bit faster, but like not as fast, like Aave. And then, yeah, the ones that don't move very fast, like Aave and Compound and Maker.
Right.
But that's, yeah, it's all trade-offs. Again, it's all trade-offs. Like if you move fast, you introduce collateral into the system that may not be safe because of a variety of reasons. Well, you have to take on the risk, and the risk gets taken on by the whole protocol. Even if the markets are separate, if you have like, say you have like the token gets sold off for insurance, then you bear that risk as a token holder. Mm-hmm. You bear that risk as a protocol. Whereas if you're just onboarding like really robust collateral that has really robust liquidity, and that liquidity has existed for a long time, then you know, you're fine. That's what Compound and Maker try to do. And that's, right. I think Compound is even more conservative than Maker at this point.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm interested as to how that's true. How is that true?
Well, I mean, Maker has actually been onboarding assets pretty quickly these days. Like if you look at like how many assets Maker has onboarded over the last few months compared to Compound, I think Maker actually wins there. Compound just, I don't know why, but like, yeah, they do move very, very slowly on that front. Compared to the others.
So here's something I've been thinking about lately. So I got into Ethereum around like July of 2017 after Ether ran from like $10 or $20 all the way up to, I think it was like $425 or something. And then it crashed back down to $135. And then it rebounded. And then it was just ranging from $330 to like $270 for like 6 weeks. It literally felt like forever. And that was like my first impression of crypto, was like Ether ranging from 330 to 270 for like, it was like August until like October. And then that's when it did its massive run all the way up to like $1,400 and said it's 2017 all-time high. It feels like that right now. Like Ether ran from $100 all the way up to $4,300, fell all the way down to $1,700. And now we've been ranging between like 2,400 and 2,800 for one week. And like what we were just talking about is like, well, we could do this, really, we could just range until like July, right? When EIP 1559 and Optimism comes online and Arbitrum allows users. Oh, that's weird. Like kind of crazy fractal, right?
Yeah, yes. So I've seen this talked about a lot lately, this fractal to 2017. And it's funny because like the magnitude is different here, because I don't think you can say maybe it ran from like 100 to 4,300, because if you're saying it ran from $10 to $420, that happened in 6 months in 2017. ETH was $10 in January of 2017, at the beginning of January,
right.
Whereas $100 was only true in March of last year. So it took us like, you know, 14-15 months to get to 4,400. So a much longer time frame there. So if you really want to do a comparison, I think you should be comparing it maybe to kind of like Bitcoin here, because Ethereum is as big as Bitcoin was back then, because it's about market cap and stuff like that. But this is also why I think that when you look at these kind of fractals and look at these charts, it's kind of hard, and I don't think it repeats like the same way every time. It might rhyme, where, you know, human emotions don't really change, and the way humans trade things and fear and greed is the same. But I don't know if you can look at that and say that's exactly what's going to happen. I do think the general rule is that when you have like a blow off top like this, you either go into like a really long term bear market where it just keeps trending down, or the market is generally bullish and you stay like range bound for a little while and then you move back up generally. Right. I think that's what is happening right now, but at the same time I'm not like totally sure, because, you know, short term is very hard to kind of predict. I didn't think that ETH would go to 1700. I thought that ETH would, you know, I was looking at when ETH was dumping. I'm like, okay, well, you know, maybe we go to under 3,000. That's where I bought some as well. I bought some at 2,900. But then, it kept falling. I'm like, wow, okay, this is a serious dump now. And then it kept going. I'm like, wow, okay, it's starting to feel like, you know, COVID Black Thursday, Black whatever it was in March of 2020. And then it dumped even more. I'm like, what the hell is happening? Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, okay, well, there must not be much liquidity in the system as I thought there was. I thought there was more liquidity than what there was. And then we bounced, of course, and went up to 2,900. I'm like, okay, this is a classic dead cat bounce right now. This is like a classic, let's all just buy the bottom. And then we trended back down. I'm like, okay, I wasn't surprised by that. And now we're just ranging. So who knows, man? Like, it's so hard to tell. But if you're in it for the long term, you should be unaffected by these. If you didn't invest more money than you can afford to lose, if you're not relying on crypto to live, then you're fine. I mean, I think... yeah, as long as you kind of like set yourself up for that and not panic sell into these sorts of things, you should be fine. Because what actually gets people long term is that they blow themselves up, whether that be on leverage or they end up panic selling and then buying back in at a higher price. Really, that's why people say hold. Because in the long term, holding, like if we just look at history,
holding wins,
exactly. Over the long term, holding wins over everything. So unless you're a trader and you're trying to be a trader, you can be a trader. You can have like a trading stack. Maybe you want to trade with 10% of your portfolio. But yeah, just generally, like I think holding wins, and you've got like proof of that from like 10 plus years of crypto markets. And that is not to say this is investment advice, but you just need to look at the industry and look at what's happened to people who held from early on. I think that's just what happens.
Yeah. And on that note, there are some things that you can't learn in crypto, you can only experience, right? And I feel like that's kind of what I was getting to when I was saying like, oh, like similar fractal as 2017 kind of feels like that. Like the numbers are messy, like time horizons are different, like things are fuzzy, but like there is like a gut feeling, right? Feeling is completely emotional. It's just my gut feeling. But also like there's like kind of this order of operations things, or like Bitcoin pumps, then Ether pumps, DeFi tokens pump, then we have this crash. Like we're what we're yet to see is another, because I remember like allocating heavy into tokens, and I feel like this is like a first cycler thing to do, is just like, oh, I missed out on the pump, better buy tokens because that's how I get my leverage. And so I bought a bunch of tokens, and then Bitcoin ran from like $7,000 to $20,000, and I just felt pain every step of the way because tokens are actually going down in price, just getting just slaughtered by Bitcoin. And then we had the biggest fucking altcoin mania of all time. And that's when Ether hit its cap. And so we just went through these cycles, right? And so it feels like the second half of the bull market, right? It feels like Ether had its first pump. Bitcoin has its first pump. DeFi tokens have kind of lagged behind, but still have done extremely well. And then we have a bunch of new entrants coming in, which a lot of people that I know that I was trying to tell them to get into crypto are now finally getting into crypto. And so it feels like that moment in time where like we have the next second half of the bull market ahead of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I actually put a tweet out saying this exact thing where it feels more like, you know, June, July, 2017 than it does Jan, 2018. And I do agree with you. I just think, it's just funny whenever you kind of look at the prices and the magnitude of the increase and how ETH went, you know, 42x before it crashed in 2017. Whereas if you look at like, say you want to compare it to the start of this year to now, you know, ETH was like, what, $1,000 at the start of this year, I think. So it's only a 4.4x. And that's because ETH's market cap is much larger this time around. And, you know, you can look at other coins that did the 42x, for example, which they did. Like some other coins did a massive run like that. So that's when I see people saying, oh, you know, ETH is going to go like 40x again because it went 40x in 2017 or whatever it was. It's like, nah, guys, like that's not going to happen. That's the market caps are way different and it takes a lot more money to move ETH these days. That's why you see Bitcoin as being like an asset that doesn't go up too much in value. But again, it goes up, but it doesn't go up as fast. And again, it's just a risk thing. Like it's less risky to be in BTC and ETH than it is to be in other things. Like, yes, BTC and ETH, I mean, ETH went down 60%, but a lot of the other things went down like 80%. And that might seem like a small gap, but going down 80% is way larger than going down 60% because it's percentage wise. It's not, not based on something else. So, that's just the risk you take. And also on the recovery, ETH and BTC are going to recover probably much faster than all these other things will. So, that's kind of like how I play it. It's like you play in the risky stuff, and it's not just risk based on market stuff. It's also risk based on the project. Like we know that BTC and ETH are going to stay around for a while, but a lot of these kind of other projects, who knows if they're going to be around? Who knows if they're going to get traction? Who knows if they're actually going to be successful? And a lot of them haven't been, and a lot of them have been slaughtered because of that. In addition to the market turning down.
Yep, totally. And that's why I feel like the way that we should leave listeners is that always, always long-term games. Always, always play, position yourself. Like, it's fun to play on leverage. I play on leverage. If you play on leverage, you have to position yourself in a way where you can still play the game even if you get punched in the face, right? So like you can take the loss, but if you're out of the game because you lost too big, then you're fucked. You're allowed to take an L, but you got to keep yourself in the game because this is a long-term revolution. And so you can't count yourself out of the revolution because honestly, you only get it one time, right? Like maybe you miss a 2017 bear market or bull market and like that sucks because you only get one 2017 bull market, but you have this one. So like, don't fuck it up. Don't fuck it up.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess like even as a broader thing, the kind of revolutions that we're seeing now within crypto is like a once in a lifetime thing or a once in a generation thing. Like the last one was the internet. They seem to be happening much faster. But when the internet was growing, like I was a kid, man. Like I couldn't experience this. Like I couldn't invest in companies. I couldn't do anything like this. So now I'm not. And I think a lot of people are in the same boat. A lot of people missed out on the internet because they were just too young. They hadn't even been born yet. I mean, think about it. Like if some people were born like people were born in the year 2000 that are now like 22 years old, 21 years old, or whatever.
Oh, that's crazy.
So when you, yeah, it is crazy. But when you think about that, it's like, okay, well, those people were literally born into the hype, of the dot-com bubble. They didn't get to experience that at all.
They were literally a product of the bubble, just people celebrating and having babies.
Exactly. So from that perspective, all those people like get to enjoy this. And even like early, like I was born in 92. So, I mean, you were as well, I
92
believe, or
gang.
like around.
Doxed.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Doxed.
But like for us, in the year 2000, we were 8 years old. I wasn't worried about that. I was worried about my Pokemon games on, Game Boy. I wasn't worried about the dot-com bubble. I didn't even know about the dot-com bubble until I was like in my teens. But so from that perspective, yeah, this is why kind of like it's a once in a generation thing, or normally once in a lifetime thing. So you make the most of it by playing long-term games and not blowing yourself up on leverage trying to capture some short-term wins.
Totally, totally. And I will take note that like if we do have DeFi Summer Round 2 or at slash DeFi Season Round 2 with L2s, that's a blessing because like we already had it once and like now we kind of know what to expect. And so that is also something to take advantage of. Anthony, thank you for coming on the Bankless Day. God, wow, the Bankless Daily Gui, Friday weekly, sometimes weekly live stream. Here's a daily, the Daily Gui YouTube channel. I'll putting it into chat. Give Anthony and his YouTube channel a follow there because he does stuff like this every single day. I listen to it on the podcast every single day, and it's where I get a lot of my information. And then we come and talk here and just kind of shitpost and have fun. And so thank you for tuning in. And Anthony, I will see you in a week.
Yep. Thanks, everyone. See you later.
Peace.